I feel like this week it does a really nice job kind of tying in with Lent and tying in kind of where we're heading with Easter and stuff too. So church calendar and our study are matching up pretty nicely right now. So let's think back to our heroes, like story arc, and we are coming around the, we're coming around the edge where we are getting into kind of really close to the climax. And so next week, what we're going to see is, last week we had our triumphal entry that Lisa talked about, and then next week we're there, okay? So we go through Judas's betrayal, Peter's betrayal of Christ, Last Supper, crucifixion, death, and burial. And so all that, we're right there. We're like poised at this moment right before that. And so I think that like where we are in the church calendar is we're right now in Lent, like waiting for the cross, waiting for resurrection, and where we are in the story is right in that same kind of essence. And so we have this anticipation, but also like we know what that story is. And so to me, like I feel like I'm like, there's parts of what we talk about today that are really uncomfortable and just like I just don't want to think about that. And even the cross, like there's this kind of like dread of what is coming. But in terms of this week for chapter 20 and 21 with themes, like the big two things that I want, the kind of takeaway that we want to think about this week is the idea that Christ's authority is real. And that's kind of the main thrust of chapter 20. And then for 21, that resurrection is real. And we get some overlap in those in both of the chapters too. But so 20 is really about Christ being the real authority, not these temple leaders. And so the choices that he makes this week is the catalyst for what comes next week or 2 weeks after spring break. and so I had this friend in college that was like kind of into like Renaissance fairs and sci-fi and that kind of thing. And so that was not really my thing, but I'm like adjacent to that kind of like nerdiness. And so she one semester at A&M, we had like all these kinesiologies that we had to take. And she was like, I really want to take fencing. We should take fencing together because that was kind of like a thing for her. And I was like, well, if you do it, I guess I'll just do it with you just so we can be together. So we decided we're going to take fencing together. She messes up her registration, and I am in fencing all by myself with like 19 and 20-year-old boys who care a lot about fencing. It was the worst thing I've ever done. You had to wear all this gear, and it smelled terrible. They were like so intense about it, and I kind of was just like, I don't really care. I nearly failed. I took it pass fail, and so I nearly failed the class because I skipped it all the time. But now I have like casual fencing knowledge, which comes up more often than you think. So what we see in chapter 20 is a fencing match, okay? So you have, I'm gonna pull out my fencing terminology. You have the Pharisees lunging at Jesus, and Jesus does a parry, which is like a defensive move, and then a riposte, which is an attack. And so you get this verbal like sparring back and forth between the Jewish leaders, not just the Pharisees, and Jesus. So anyway, what the essence is here is that he is at this point in the story. He's ready to engage. This is why he came. All of this has been leading up to this moment. So we have in lunge number one, at the very beginning of chapter 20, you have the first lunge that they take is where does Christ get his authority? This is the first jab. And so I'm going to read it. I won't read all of the text because I don't have time, but I'll read some of these small ones. One day, as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts and proclaiming the good news, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, together with the elders, came up to him. Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? They said, who gave you this authority? And so he's in this bind where if he claims authority from God, then they're going to say that you are blasphemous. If he claims authority from the people, then they're saying that you're here for a power grab, like you have this power lust or whatever. And so they think that they've got him. And so the false assumption, the like fallacy right here is that he doesn't have legitimate authority. And that's a myth because he does have authority. And the other false assumption is that they are the ones that have the authority. And what he's about to do is to kind of reveal the truth of this. And so his parry or his defense is, he replies in verse 3, I will also ask you a question. And so do you see the way this is a power move. He turns that around and he says, you are not the ones who get to ask all the questions. I have some questions for you. And he says, tell me. And even in that, like this is this imperative. I'm commanding you. You tell me. And which seems like to them must have seemed kind of impertinent. But for him, he is the one with actual authority. Tell me. John's baptism, was it from heaven or from human origin? They discussed it among themselves and said, if we say from heaven, he'll ask, why didn't you believe him? But if we say of human origin, all the people will stone us because they're persuaded that John was a prophet. And so they answered, we don't know where it was from. And so he has kind of like stonewalled them. And Jesus said, neither will I tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. And so he's bucking their authority. He's not answering their questions. He's asking the questions at this point. And so for us, as we read this, we know that his authority is coming from both of these things, and that's not a problem. He's not being blasphemous to say his authority is from God, because he is God. He's not bucking for, like, this is not like a power grab, because he does have the power. And so this is not, it's not a problem. Okay, and so then he has this defensive sort of verbal defense, and then he goes on the attack. And so he goes on the offensive in this next section. And so it's starting in verse 9. He went on to tell the people this parable. A man planted a vineyard, rented it to some farmers, and went away for a long time. And at harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants so they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. But the tenants beat him and sent him away empty-handed. And he sent another servant, but that one they also beat and treated shamefully and sent away empty-handed. And he sent still a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. And then the owner of the vineyard said, what shall I do? I'll send my son, whom I love, and perhaps I'll respect him. But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said. Let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. And so they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. And so we have this dramatic irony in this parable, because we know this is what is about to go down with Jesus himself. And then what then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? He'll come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. And when the people heard this, they said, God forbid. And there's this like pun almost, or like this wordplay happening, because this is exactly God's bidding. He didn't forbid it. Christ is doing his bidding by going and sacrificing himself. And Jesus looked, and then this is like the moment. Jesus looked directly at them and asked. And so there's this tension right here where you're almost like balancing like on a fulcrum. And so Jesus right here at this point, when he's doing that direct looking, he steps forward. Okay. And so then everything else after this is falling towards the cross, because they're closing the noose around him, but willingly he's allowing that to happen. He looked directly at them and asked, then what's the meaning of that which is written? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, and anyone on whom it falls will be crushed. And the teachers of the law and the chief priests looked for a way to arrest him immediately, because they knew he had spoken this parable against them, but they were afraid of the people. And so this is, back to our allusion or illustration, this is a touch. And so this is like a rhetorical point for Jesus. He has said exactly what he meant to say, and it has hit home. They know that he is speaking the truth. They're feeling it. And so he claims his authority in this moment, and he is clarifying who has the audacity, because they're sort of thinking, how audacious of you to talk this way to us. And what he's saying is like, how audacious of you for living this life and talking to me this way. And so there's this flip in what's going on. And the whole parable is like reframing their identity, his identity, who has authority. And so the story, like that question that they asked in the beginning of like, where did you get your authority? The parable is the answer to that question. He tells them, I'm God's son, I am God. That's where I get my authority. And this idea that like, you think that I'm trespassing, you're treating me like you can push me and take advantage of my father's like resources, but I'm the son, I own all of this. You are the one who is trespassing. And so there is also that talk about the cornerstone. And so I think the point here is that any interaction with that rock is transformative. And so whether you fall on that, and if that is in like surrender to God, that you are broken to pieces, or whether it falls on top of you and you are crushed. But either way, that is, it's painful, and it changes you, whichever side you are. Okay, and so then we shift down into lunge number 2. And so this is, again, the Pharisees are coming after him. And this is over taxes with Caesar. And so keeping a close watch on him, they sent spies who pretended to be sincere. And they hoped to catch Jesus in something he said so that they might hand him over to the power and authority of the governor. And so the spies questioned him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach what's right, and you don't show partiality, but teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" And so this whole thing, so to choose either, like, again, they think they've put him in this, like, rhetorical bind. But to choose either one, like, to choose that, yes, you need to pay the taxes, they think that this is going to put him out of favor with the Jews who did not like the tax. And to say that you don't need to pay the tax is going to put him out of favor with the Romans, who are the ones who are demanding the tax. And so they think that they've got him. But the logical fallacy here is that this is a false either-or situation. It is a false binary. And so what they're really trying to do is make him choose between this, do you respect sacred or do you respect secular more? And so they're trying to they're trying to make him extreme in that. You know, they want to are you totally is your allegiance totally with religion, totally with this unpolluted devotion to God, or are you declaring allegiance to Caesar? And what he says is that I don't have to choose between these. And so his defense, his parry here, is that he saw through their duplicity and said to them, "Show me a denarius. Whose image and inscription are on it?" "Caesar's," they replied. And he said to them, "Then give back to Caesar what's Caesar's and to God what's God's." And they were unable to trap him in what he had said there in public. And astonished by his answer, they became silent. And so he holds the denarius with correct assessment of its value. He says, "This is nothing. This has no hold on me. It's just a coin. And so it can come and go. It doesn't take anything away from me to lose it." So money is not our God. We worship God and not this coin. And so he answers that wrong kind of binary or whatever by saying that we can do both of these, that I lose no authority in submitting to the law of the land. He's the king. He knows it. And the kingdom goes where he goes. He retains his total authority, even submitting to this. And again, the real issue with this lunge is they're again questioning his authority. You know, are you superior or is Caesar superior? And again, he's answering this, I still retain authority. And so then we go into lunge number 3, and this is kind of centering around marriage after the resurrection. So verse 27, "Some of the Sadducees who say there's no resurrection came to Jesus with a question. 'Teacher,' they said, 'Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but no children, that the man must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother.' And now there were 7 brothers. The first one married a woman and died childless. The second and then the third married her. And in the same way, the 7 died, leaving no children. And finally, the woman died too. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be, since the 7 were married to her?" And it told us in the study that the Sadducees didn't even believe in resurrection. And so this whole situation is just a farce. They are, again, questioning his authority, and they're questioning, does resurrection even, is that even a thing? And so he understands where they're coming from. So it's this silly riddle that they've come up with is silly. And so this is another trap. It's this convoluted hypothetical situation that doesn't make any, it's not tied to real life. And so their real point is that you say there's a resurrection. If there's a resurrection, then what would happen in this? But it's really to disprove resurrection. And so the false assumption here is that there's marriage after resurrection anyway. And I would say the even greater false fallacy here is that we would be super concerned with earthly relationships in heaven, that would be our number one intimacy. And so he comes back with that idea. I'm not going to read this whole box. I'm just going to read 34 and 35. But his defense here, Jesus replies, "The people of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of taking part in the age to come and in the resurrection," do you hear that that's kind of a little jab too, "those who are worthy of taking part, and in the resurrection from the dead will neither marry nor be given in marriage." And so this is the answer to that, is that this will not be your priority. And I think for us, maybe that's hard to get a hold of, because this is a big, important thing for a lot of us. But he's saying your whole paradigm will be different after the resurrection. And so And the idea that like this silly thing would be what could disprove resurrection just seems a little bit crazy to me. But we will be bonded and have this most intimate relationship with our heavenly groom. And so the Sadducees are referring to this Old Testament law that said that it's the next of kin's responsibility to take care of and to marry the widow, to have a child by her. And so like for them, if you're not believing in resurrection, then the idea of having children becomes like super important. That's your only, like that would be the closest that you could get to an afterlife, to eternal life. Is that your genes would pass on or your values would pass on. And so for them, like this issue of like having kids becomes of utmost importance. But for us, that pressure is not there because we do believe in resurrection. And we do get like this assurance of his eternal, like intimate union with us. And then he moves down into like, there's these two appeals, kind of this Moses appeal and then this David appeal that happens after it. And so in the Moses appeal, he is quoting scriptural authority to the Sadducees who really valued scripture. And so he's using kind of their own tools against them a little bit and say like in these kind of proofs. But he's using that as proof of the resurrection when he's talking about Moses. He identifies himself as this very present and living God of the currently existing Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's citing Moses and the burning bush story to call Yahweh the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God of the living and not the dead. And then he has the David appeal. And again, he's using scripture to these people because that is what is going to hit home with them and kind of like stop them a little bit. He's using the Father's words as logical proofs to this audience. It's also this echo of Luke 18 with a blind beggar who cried out, who called Jesus the Son of David, Son of David, Son of David. And we have note of this here again. And so this is Psalm 110. And what you hear in that quote, there are like echoes of the Trinity in that, that there is this dialogue between the Father and the Son there. And then you have David's, the way that David addresses Jesus is as one with superior rank. And so they're saying this is his kind of proof that he's from the line of David. So like biologically, he's coming from that line. But in terms of power and authority, that Christ is superior. Okay, and so then he goes on the attack. In verse 45, while all the people were listening, Jesus said to his disciples, "Beware of the teachers of the law." Okay, and this is super bold. They like to walk around in flowing robes and love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and have the most important seats in the synagogues and in the places of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for a show make lengthy prayers. And these men will be punished most severely. And as Jesus looked up, he saw the rich putting their gifts into the temple treasury. And he also saw a poor widow put in two very small copper coins. "Truly, I tell you," he said, "this poor widow has put in more than all the others. And all these people gave their gifts out of their wealth, but she, out of her poverty, put in all she had to live on." They are circling the noose, and he is taking really, really explicit, like direct jabs at them. He is calling them out for their sin. He calls them out for devouring this predatory sort of attitude that they have towards the most vulnerable in society. They're behaving like con artists or scammers or bullies. Like they are just like pouncing on these people who have nothing. You can feel that. He wants that to end. He wants to call that out. And so you have this description of these people that are gilded on the outside, bright and shiny and beautiful on the outside, but there's this hollow sort of rotten core inside of them. And that's what he is pinpointing here. And so the idea of like walking around in flowing robes, that they get to their status, like their strokes or whatever, from their outward appearance, that they love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces, that they are getting status and privilege from in the area of business, the most important seats in the synagogues, that they're getting that, they're working for that in the church, that they have places of honor at banquets, that their social life is this too. And so, I mean, like, it is not hard for me to look at my own life and to feel that hollowness in myself also. And I think that we, like, should be cautious. I think this is a really great, like, warning. I think all of these two chapters are really great for sort of like going inside and saying like, where am I getting my status and my like gold stars? Am I valuing how much like thought time, how much of my resources am I putting towards these kind of things? Where when I go to the synagogue, when I put on my flowing robes, when I have any sort of social situation, like, is that what I'm valuing it? Am I behaving in this kind of like Pharisaical way? And he talks also about like for a show, they make lengthy prayers. And I just want to say that the problem is not the lengthy prayer. I think the problem is that it's putting on the show. We know that like with the story of the persistent widow, that it's good to go to God again and again in your prayers. But the problem is that this is like this very public and showy thing. And I'm not going to make this about myself, but it was very hard. I was like, oh, my lectures are really long and maybe I need to like trim this down a little bit. But I think that it's good to kind of think through like just like if we are like on a stage, like is it about the show or is it about the heart? And I think that for me, can I go in and kind of like have certain checks, you know? Do I feel thankful? And this could be like in the church or service outside the church or wherever your ministry is, but to like recognize that like any productivity that I have is coming straight from the Holy Spirit, that this is not like a count of like my wonderful gifts, that I'm thankful that I get to use any gifts, whether that's with like my kids or here or any kind of service around the community, that that is a gift to me, that I get to like exercise that stuff and kind of flex those muscles rather than like, oh, aren't I being so wonderful to these poor other people? And that like, I think my hope is that like wherever that is, whatever that ministry is in our lives, that would be like eliciting real worship, like in a heartfelt kind of way. And I know that that's hard to like, how do you sustain that in your life? And I know, you know, like we were talking about the Pharisees as being hypocrites. Like if you believe in anything, then you're going to be a hypocrite. And so like to play that line, I think is a delicate sort of thing. But I think to have it where you're inspecting your motivations, like in a regular kind of way, I think is really important. And I do think, because you don't want to be on the other side of this where you're like I'm a hip, like I fail, like I sin, and so I'm never going to be qualified to do the ministry. That kind of thing that's like keeping you from stepping forward in it either. And so I think it's somewhere in between that. And you do, with the poor widow at the end, this is his final jab from Jesus to say, look at what she is doing and look at what she has, like this humility and generosity. And that contrast between her and the leaders is this final jab where he's saying, she has it right and what you're doing is not that. Okay, and then we move into chapter 21, which is all the end times kind of talk, which gets to be like a little bit overwhelming. And there are a lot of like opinions floating around in the church about the timing of everything. And so there's no way that I can talk to you in 10 minutes and like cover this in a super thorough way. But I did put a timeline on here, which I think is really interesting for this specific text. Let's go ahead and read this like 5 through 11, and then we'll talk about a timeline right after it. So some of his disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus said, as for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down. Teacher, they asked, when will these things happen and what will be the sign that they're about to take place? Okay, I'm going to pause right here. Because what I have in the timeline, if you just skip down right below that. In 968, that's when Solomon constructed his temple. 586 is when Solomon's temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. In 516, this other guy, I'm not even going to try to say it, reconstructs like a smaller version of the temple. And then in 19, so a lot later, Herod comes into this diminished kind of smaller temple and enlarges and beautifies it. And so what the disciples are talking about right now, where they are standing, is in this renovated temple that Herod has constructed. And so that's what they're looking around and they're saying, wow, like this is really beautiful. Okay, but then right at like, so then we have the action of our story with Christ and the crucifixion. And then after that, in 66 AD, Jerusalem rebels against the Roman Empire, and Rome in 70 AD, this is really important. So all the stuff that they're going to talk about as like prophecy here in a second, like that, a lot of that goes down in 70 AD because Rome destroys the temple. And so what Jesus just said, that like every one of these stones is going to be torn down, that actually happened. Okay, so that stuff came to pass in 70 AD. And even when, well, I'll wait, we'll talk about it in a second. But so 70 AD is when Romans are destroying Herod's temple. And then the Gospel of Luke was written about a decade after that. Okay. And so the warning about the destruction of the temple happens. The warning about ongoing discord, where it says that the end will not come right away. This is going to take a while. I think we can think of that in terms of like, okay, well, it was a little bit after that that the temple was torn down. But we could think of that stretching in even into today. This ongoing discord, like certainly we could feel that. The warning about a false second coming or like these other messiahs, like we could stretch that even in today. And I think you can think like on a metaphorical level, you know, like what in my life is, am I placing in a Messiah kind of role to make it like personal? But it's not hard to see that these things, some of these things definitely came true and some are like ongoing even now. And so then we shift into kind of this section that I would say is a little bit more encouraging, just that they're not that bad things aren't going to happen, but that he would be a help in those things. But before all this, they'll seize you and persecute you. And I think you can think about this, especially in terms of like what you read in Acts. And so the disciples that he's talking to, like the stuff that he says is going to happen to some of them, like in their in this generation. And so to think of it on that level, I think is helpful too. They will hand you over to synagogues and put you in prison, and you will be brought before kings and governors, and all on account of my name. And so you'll bear testimony to me. But make up your mind not to worry beforehand how you'll defend yourselves, for I'll give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or contradict. You'll be betrayed even by parents, brothers and sisters, relatives and friends, and they'll put some of you to death. And everyone will hate you because of me, but not a hair of your head will perish. Stand firm and you will win life. And so this is like for these people who are standing there, there is like this element of like preparatory kind of warning, like this is coming, but I'm telling you this because I love you and because I want to prepare you. And so we do see that happen in Acts, and the idea that he'll give you words and wisdom to overcome. And then you have that statement about like, but not a hair on your head will perish. Okay, and so we read that knowing that like throughout history that martyrs have been killed. And so Christ is talking on a spiritual level that they may kill your body, but eternally you have been given life and protection, spiritual protection. And so again, it's not hard to see. These things have come to pass in history and are even around the world continuing on. And then we go into the specific stuff about Jerusalem in 20 through 24. I'm not gonna read the text on this one, but again, these are predictions of things that really happened in 70 AD. And if you read in the study, he takes this like extra biblical reference from Josephus, which is like this historical record. And so where he talks about that the city was surrounded by armies, yes, that really happened, that the citizens are fleeing out of the city. Yes, they do that. That it's dreadful for pregnant and nursing women, that there's distress in the land and wrath to the people, that they're put to the sword and in prison, and that the city of Jerusalem is trampled by Gentiles. All of that like literally happened in 70 AD. And so this passage, and then this is usually considered a parallel with Matthew 24 and then some stuff in Revelation also. This is a little bit more limited scope. If you go into Matthew, into Revelation, I think is a bigger picture of all of this. But then we go into the heavens and the earth are raging. And so you get this like creation is groaning kind of section. And so some people say, and I'm going to try not to bog down in this, but some people say that there is a shift like between verse 24 and 25. And so everything through 24, like that was the literal stuff that happened to Jerusalem in 70 AD. And some people say that there's a shift right here in 25. And this is like the end times. Okay. So the second coming sort of stuff. And I just want to point out kind of the basics here in our text, that there are signs, he says, to watch for signs in the heavenly bodies, that there are nations in anguish over the raging seas, that the heavenly bodies are shaken, and that the Son of Man comes on a cloud. And so this is my personal opinion. I don't think there's an easy line of demarcation here. I think a lot of these like prophecies are kind of mixed up. I think we can see them in history and we can see now, like I think you could make reference for this today, some of it. And so, yeah, people want to talk about like the rapture and will believers be here during those trials? And if you want to debate that, then talk in your small groups. But what I will focus on here is that it does say, like, even though these things seem really kind of like intimidating and terrifying, that he does say to stand up and lift up your heads, that these signs are perplexing, but this is a good thing. It means that, you know, even though it will be, that is terrible, but it means that resurrection is coming. And he says that it means that your redemption is drawing near and that it is ultimately a good thing. And then he goes into the section of 29 through 36 of like preparatory stuff. And I feel like he really is trying to talk to the disciples here. But he says, look for the signs that creation will pass away, but his words will never pass away. And it's this like tone of be ready, don't be distracted. And so like, in conclusion, like our themes, the big thing kind of takeaway that I want us to have this week is like mainly for chapter 20, that Christ is the real authority, and for 21, that resurrection is real. And that should be like a boon to us, like an encouragement. And so we live in like this weird time where we have one foot in the present reality, but we're stepping towards the future in this, that there will be an end to this life. And that is like both like terrible, but also like wonderful, that he has even better things in store for us. He has this new life, a new heavens, a new earth, and that is a wonderful thing. And so we see that the temple leaders are undermining Christ's authority and undermining resurrection itself in various forms this week. And so on a personal level, like an application kind of level, I want us to be thinking about like what is undermining Christ's authority in your life? Like what are you listening to that's undermining that? And also like what is chipping away at your hope for resurrection? Like what is distracting you from that? That there's good, beautiful things coming after death, where wrongs are righted, and that we could be like optimistic and have this hope that heaven is real. I went to a funeral yesterday in my hometown, this terrible, terrible situation of somebody who was like a really close family friend, like lived a few houses down. We went to church with them, and it was, I don't know if I should go into details, but he committed suicide, and like the whole town was there. You know, I come from this really small town. Everybody is there at the funeral. And it, like, I don't know, you sit through stuff like that, and I don't know, you're just kind of like reeling from it a little bit. And so, like, I had, like, when I am feeling that, I feel like I have to fall back on the hope of resurrection. That after, like, whether you're thinking about end times or just the, like, insanity of life and adult life, and that things end badly a lot, that after this destruction, after all of the conflict and the panic that we have here, that we could come through it all and stand before the Son of Man as a relief, that would be a beautiful thing. And my hope that is with, like, I don't know, the destruction and death of life, that the Son of Man, that I would know him face to face and feel his authority, that he would have authority over the great, terrible tragedies of life, but also over like these glorious and beautiful things that we get pictures of also, just new life, like all over the place. And that is like such a wonderful thing. And so I pray that for me and for all of us, that we would continually fall on that rock, that it would, even though it would be painful, that would be a beautiful remaking of us. And I want to believe that and just pray that he helps my unbelief. And I'm going to read this last section from Revelation 21. And then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. All right, guys, let me pray for our time upstairs. Father God, I thank you for this time with the ladies. God, I pray for everybody's discussion upstairs and for spring break, that this would be just a good time for everybody. I pray that we would know you more and be curious about you. We love you. Amen.